today the tutorial, as I mumbled, that you need a Mathematica. You're not writing much code per se. It's just that it will ask you to check some things. When you open notebook, you see that very non-friendly looking matrix. You will know that why we need a Mathematica for. And the other thing is, I passed some feedback form out. I'll try to remember at the end of the lecture to ask you to fill it out, but let's see. See if I can remember. Okay, so let's start with the lecture. What we learned yesterday is it seems that if you want to connect the quantum mechanics and the theory of special relativity, it seems we need to know about group theory. And what we learned, on the other hand, we learned yesterday, we need to answer this question. And what we learned is this is a unitary representation of some group, a non-unitary, but mostly unitary group. It is. You want me to take it? Okay, so then what do we learn about how to study a group? Keyword, how to study a group.
Symmetry.
Group describes symmetry, but if we really want to study, the group is very abstract. Yeah, go ahead.
Representation.
Very good. We need to find a representation, and it seems there's something called the irreducible representation would be nice. We can just stitch them together to build the reducible one. I mean, diagonal, block diagonal matrix. Who cares about them? Well, we do. Sorry. But this is what we want. And I say if we find the representation, since they act on some vector space, we'll find the states. So that's the plan for today and tomorrow. So yesterday I gave you a keyword. The keyword is rotation. It seems that the interesting transformation that is a symmetry and is described by the group is all related to rotation somehow for us. And today, second lecture, the keyword is structure. So then what we want to see is how representation tells us about the structure of the group. I'll try to reflect on this structure of the group a second. And how the structure, once you find the structure, it will help us to find the sum of the representation. So the interplay between two of them. So that will be the sum. So that's the summary of the lecture. Okay, so Omar asked me this question. It's a very important question. The more I think about it, it's more important. So this question says, okay, I have to do some definition, not much. So this is just a list of real parameters. So I don't want to use a new notation to confuse you. So that's just, if it doesn't have an index, it's the collection. If it has an index, it's the component, kind of like Mathematica. Okay, that's all I want to say about it. And now I want to grab a group element. And I realize no matter what numeric or ABC index I put on it, it might be confusing because that's not what I want to do. I don't want to number them. There's beyond infinity of group members, if you think about it, just like, okay, you have an uncountable infinity amount of members just in U1. And when once you go beyond U1, you have just so many of them. So I figured there are so many shapes. So I'm just going to use this dot so that it's just the, it's a group element I randomly pull out of the thin air, if you want to interpret it that. Okay? That dot doesn't take any values. It's just that the dot will distinguish it from other group member like a G star. I realize star might be confused with complex conjugate. Okay, some random shape that is very easily distinguished from the dot. And then this one will have the same idea. It depends on some parameter. I mean, that's how we find the parameters, right? The group member depends on some parameter. And then Omar has this great question that I would use even a new column to write it out. The first line is something we already know. Is the two group element I pull out of in the thin air, it'll give me another group element. Yeah? Very good. This is the called the closeness of the group. If you have a group, this works. And then you can think of it as like pointers. This, the first one is pointed by this phi dot, and the other one is pointed by this phi starry things. And the last one, of course, is pointed by this. So this is just some set. This is some set of parameters. I'm not taking any value. It's just the set of the parameters that are corresponding to that group member. And it has some sort of funny labels to tell us that who is who. And now is a question. Now here is Omar's question. Omar says, since the only thing, the entire thing we know about the group member is characterized by these parameters, then they must be related. It makes sense? See, this one says you need nothing but the G dot and G start to produce this other G. And all the information is captured in this parameters, phi dot and a phi star. Then phi must be related to them. So how are they related? Well, we don't know, right? This is called the structure of the group. So we don't know, but we know it's related, so we just write down as a general function of the other sets of parameters. Do you agree? At this point, we know nothing. The only thing we know is it's related to these two. We can't say it's the addition, it's the multiplication, it's the exponential, whatever function you throw there, you were like, but what if it's another different group? So the only thing we can say is that it's a function depend on them. But we do know something about this function. Okay. Here are some interesting observations. Suppose both of those are zero. What do you think the function will give us? We'll give us zero. Let's go through this because this is important. We say Lie group is the best when we choose parameter zero, it corresponds to identity. Then we have identity times identity equals identity, come back to zero. Okay, very good. So now the question is, what if we only have the first entry is non-zero? There's only this set of parameter. This is still zero. What would you get? The only thing we know is this. That's zero. That doesn't give us any more useful information.
F of phi dot.
F of phi dot, that's right. But now, let's try to go back to the same idea. If you know phi dot, then it gives you g dot. That, you know nothing, it's the identity. And g dot times identity, because identity, so it's g dot. And you can come back to realize. Yes, can you simplify this further? It's phi dot. If you not know nothing beyond the first thing, you'll get the first thing back. Of course, as a image, then if you, it's not a billion, but the situation is symmetrically when you have identity. If you say the first thing is identity, you get that thing back. You're like, how is this going to help us to determine this completely general function phi, f? Well, we'll come back to this. We'll use this very soon, okay? But first, what we want to do is we have representations. We should use them. We learned about the unitary representations. The first line, I hope you agree, the first line simply say the definition of a unitary representation. It maintains the multiplication. Yeah? Okay, the next thing is we're going to say g dot is sort of dependent on phi dot completely, and g star is sort of completely dependent on phi star. And then this thing, as we have make a comment that I have no idea what it is, but it gotta be the function of the two things we know. Yeah. So U is a function of a G, sort of. U is a map of a G, and G is a map between its parameters. I just say G, we'll throw it away. That's fine. We have some matrix multiplication to do. Okay, so what do we move from here? It's still complicated. Oh, by the way, so I kind of think we're on an adventure about a QFT. So adventurers always carry a toolbox. And from today, we'll start building our toolbox, and you will see these toolbox very useful. Okay, so what do I say? Yes, this is hard, but can we make it easier by observing these fun facts? When do you think the group is easier to study? Which element is the easiest element to study in the group? Very good. I see some fingers pointing. Very nice. Identity, right? Okay, very good. But we're not looking at the matrices. So identity of matrix, perfectly easy to study. And what can we do to study something around it. Yeah? What do you think? The idea is, if identity is so easy to study, maybe if we're very close to identity, it's easy to study too. I might be wrong, but worth a try, right? So how do you get close to the identity? Come back to the parameters, right? Parameters is here. How can we get close to identity? You want the parameters to be close to be zero. So the first two in our box is infinitesimal expansion. Whenever we were stuck with something finite and we don't know what to do, give infinitesimal a try. So instead of studying all those things, we say this is a M by M matrix. Nevertheless, I can expand it around the identity. And then if we're expanding around with the parameters should show up, right? But can this be good? Can this be a good equation? This is my M by M matrix. This is M by M matrix. Oh yeah, just a bunch of numbers. This doesn't work, right? So we'll give it some M by M matrix. For each parameter, we'll throw it a M by M matrix just to make this expansion work. And as a physicist, we decide to include the I. You will see why we included the I in a minute. But this is the expansion. So I don't know how to do that, but let's try this. The next thing you do is, before we try that, it would be, okay, suppose I actually know the infinitesimal thing. Do I gain any information if I want to go to a finite range? Turns out you can, very formally defined. I'm not saying that I have done this any time in my life, but this is what people do, is use this identity, which I think I have proven before, but it's been so long. But hopefully you recall that there are some definition of exponential function is as a limit of something. And then what they claim, a group, generic group, is that you do this infinitesimal once infinite times. It's a bunch of definition here. And you're like, yeah, no problem. If you have some infinite finite thing, I'll just chop it down into infinitesimal thing, and I do it infinite times. That's the formal definition. How would you get a finite group member? Well, I mean, it's basically using the idea, if one of them is a group member, then you can do many times because the closeness, you will never get something else. So you can say this is the definition of a group member with a finite distance. Okay, so how all this is gonna help me? Good question, right? Okay, so we say unitary representation. So what does unitary tell us? What's unitary in equation form? What do we know about a U?
U dagger is 1.
U dagger equals 1. That's the first information we get from choosing a unitary representation. Okay. Now this is actually kind of cool. Let's do the linear expansion of this. And it's two lines, so why don't you do it? Okay, I'll give you 2 minutes. Quickly write down two lines. And the question is, what can we say about this? The matrix, they bring it, which is often known as the generator. Yes, if you're looking at me, that means you have finished computation. Okay. What conclusion do you have? Anyway, in the other way, in physically, I mean, what do we hope they are? They are some operators. Physically, we hope they are. They are Hermitian. That's where I come from. If you don't put I, then you get anti-Hermitian. But we want observables. Okay, so I'm also doing it. The whole point of me doing it is to show that I'll be using some convention, so-called the Einstein convention. You probably have already seen. Just that whenever there is a sum, and there are two identical things to be summed over, then I'll not write the sum. It will make life much easier later, trust me. So if you see a pair of index and they look the same, we just assume they have summed over. Okay, and the next thing I want to emphasize, the other thing I did is I forgot, I stopped carrying the M by M matrix because everything is M by M matrix. But the thing I want to emphasize is whenever you are asked to do the first order, that means we're ignoring the second order because we're only given the first order. We can't, like if you can't conjugate what's the next term, then the second order produced in this equation can simply be discarded because we need new information to prime that, which we actually will do. I don't think I'm going to do that many second order computation in this class, but this one deserves its place because that's when we finally have some answer for this question, what is the structure of the group? So the first thing unitary gives us Hermitian operator. Okay, that's pretty cool, I like it. Oh, okay. It's just the beginning words on my notes that's second order. I'm a little. Uh, Okay, this is going to be a slightly longer calculation than we have seen, but it's very fruitful. And in the end, there's a bunch of parts I think you can just do on your own. Now I'll skip it. But the beginning is very enlightening. Beginning says, now we will expand to the second order. Hence, we need something new called LAB. And if you ask, everybody knows what's group generator, and then you ask them, what's LAB? What? But to carry out this calculation, we do need a second term. So we can work it out. Okay, so this is the second term. And by looking at this, what do you think LAB has, the important property is useful? That's how we can get rid of it later. By looking at this expansion, what do you conclude about the LABs? The symmetry factor, right? It's symmetric, so it better be symmetric. You can have anti-symmetric component, but you're not going to contribute anything, so symmetric. Okay, so hula, this is going to be fun. Still, not we're not at the we will sigh at the computation first. So naively, ignore what we have learned so far. We just have a function of two variables. I want to do second order expansion. What does it have? It have zeros order and linear order. For one of them, well, we'd better have the other one. Right? Then we have the second order. There is one guy says both of the parameters contribute. And there's two more guys says only one kind of parameters contribute. Okay, that's all the terms I can write down. I don't have to need to know any information. So I can, as I said yesterday to you, the answer is not simple. But we have some enlightened discovery before. I mean, this discovery, we made it without them to be infinitesimal. But of course, it holds if it's infinitesimal. So what does the first line tells us? F 0, 0 equals 0. When both parameters vanish, it should go back to the identity. Yes. I think someone said the correct answer. Can you be louder? Look at the three lines. If I take both parameter to zero, what would happen? This one, zero, right? Okay, very good. Five more to go. But let's look at the second one. Second one, it says, if I take st- star to be zero, it should go back to epsilon. Okay, in this line, I forgot to mention, but the Einstein summation is assumed. So they should all have a free index called A to match with this one. Okay, so let's say epsilon stars all is all taken to be zero. How could what we have left go back to epsilon A
star
dot? Find a star and erase them. And let's first look at this term. What can this term be? Your full answer. So remember, this is not a linear expansion. It says you will get back to yourself, period. And this term seems to be telling us something different. It's saying you're going to have a second order. So you're the better out. Okay? See, not bad, not bad. And then what we left is this. How can be this with the summation go back to epsilon A dot? Yep. Perfect. This needs to be the chronic delta. Similarly, I hope you are convinced, this will also go to delta BA, and this will also go to zero. So this annoying looking thing turned out to be, well, much nicer than the first time we see it. So it says in the linear level, it's the summation of two things, except on the quadratic, there's going to pick up a new term. But we shouldn't be unhappy about the first two terms. If you're thinking about U1 rotation, you do a little bit of rotation, a little bit of rotation, or even bigger rotation, you can just add them up. So that part we shouldn't be happy with. Then there is that term. Well, that term I really have nothing for you. So we'll look at the expressions together to gain a feeling that why the result, the calculation is not as crazy as it shows us. And I'll leave some, not too many algebra. See, the whole algebra still fit in the page for you to explore. Okay, so this is what we got. And then now let's see. The first, this part is cute. It says that is actually my, this thing. One of this thing. This is actually my infinitesimal parameter. This whole thing. So when you do the expansion, we need to take the whole thing, which I'll write down the summation this time. So that's the part we know, the linear part. It's going to be an addition somewhere. But the thing we don't know is this crazy part. And then you give it a TA. Summation is not good. I have to write ABC. Sorry, no summation. Just practice that we don't ever write it down. Okay. So that's our linear expansion now. Yeah, remember this whole thing is our small parameter. So the linear expansion should take the whole thing, give it an I, give it a TA. So that's what we are. But we're not done yet, because now we have a second term. Remember, there's also this LAB. We don't know what they are. Nobody knows. But it doesn't matter. And I already only take the first order, because they're going to multiply together, give me the second order. These things don't show up again. OK, so that's the left-hand side. To make it better, I'm going to. And then you were like, this is actually give us something with all these crazy terms? Yes, we will. And the next thing is do the second order expansion. And these will be two identical lines having all this. There's nothing to complain this side. It says take your second order expansion and multiply them together. This one is a little tricky, because you think that's a second order expansion, but that's what we solved for f. So we need to plug it in. And also we're expanding to second order now. Okay, so that's what we're gonna stare at. And trust me, the first order is going to disappear. The first order, we just solved it. It's those things together. OK, zeros order, the identity is not going to be there. First order includes this thing multiplied by TA equals itself. Only looking at the second order. And this we have to keep, because there's nothing look like that. But this one, though, so be together with me. This one, it's going to have three terms. Yeah? It's like a plus b squared. It's going to give us three terms. The middle two terms can be combined together because of the symmetry. And those three terms find a realize, okay, this disappear is to disappear, and only the middle term remains. Okay? So, and the only thing left is the cross term between these two. That one will give you a second order term, because none of them has more than one t, so that one will stay. So I'm going to write down, in the end, what happened? You throw away a bunch of terms, you know they are at zero. So there are three terms. The thing that has two t's, it can't find a partner to cancel. The term comes with d, that cannot find anything to cancel. And whatever the dust is remained, which is this term. Okay, so here is when you do a trick and then make your life simpler. The trick is, because this is symmetric, so I can write down another line with B and A switched. And now you subtract two lines, disregard the L. So that's where the LAB never mattered, because it is symmetric. And then The rest is kind of renaming the index and try to make sure they actually cancel. So I'm going to skip that part. But the idea is because you have a TATB, and now you switch it, and you also subtract it, it become commutator. Okay, so this part I'm not going to show you how to do, because I know you can do it for sure. And there's not much I need to mention besides the fact we have to play a trick, call you symmetric, and then subtract. So then nobody cares about the D anymore. The people only cares about is this Fs. And that's all we get out of that structure of the group constant. So this is the structure of the group, and also known as the Lie algebra. Lie algebra is the small vicinity of the identity of the Lie group, which is what we have been doing the whole time. And let's say this is a box set, so it's very important. And this is what we spend a half of a lecture is to arrive at the firm point says, oh, now I know the structure of the Lie group, and they were very happy. And notice that because all this subtraction, it's anti-symmetric at A and B because of the commutator. And the only, okay, 2 minutes, then we can take a break, is that the only thing we want to say is actually if you look at what we, oh, this cute definition is that the Lie algebra, the Lie group is the exponent of Lie algebra. And there is this amazing identity that tells us how to combine two things that are exponential together, called Becker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. We are not going to use it. But I just want to point it out if you're combining two groups together. This basically says J dot times G star. And the rest, the right hand side will tell you how to find the multiplication. Yeah? You find the representation, take the I times phi times t, and you can use this formula. But what it does tell you is that it needs the commutator. But that's it. All the rest of this formula looks crazy, but every single of them is a nested commutator. It says as long as you know commutator, you're fine. But we can do this commutator and then do the commutator of them, and everything is captured by the Lie algebra. So before we say, we want to find the rep of the Lorentz group or the Poincaré group. And now we're slightly more happy. We only need to find the representation of the Poincaré algebra, which is 10 of them. So compared to infinity, we should be happy with 10. Okay, so let's take the 5 minute break and we'll come back to see what the structural constants gives us about the representations.
Professor.
Yeah.
Is it like for the dimensions and stuff?
For the dimension of the so far. Yes. So the A, so T A could be a matrix, could be a matrix. But T itself, the subscript A, is one single hard
level.
It's like three rotations.
No, bro, I'm literally like, it's possible to have a little group and like, wait for now, like, or
yeah, what should they do?
Your first 1-0 and one component of the transformation is bigger or less than bigger than one or less than minus one.
Okay.
You actually normally we only talk about the post positive, medically, spiritually.
So the idea is like you would generate the structure in one part and then you can relate that to
I can redo that expansion. There's got to be something. It's just not important. It's definitely there. But now let's say that I want to okay. So Sarah, the comments.
Several comments about this thing. This is very important, and you have it, you have the structure of the group. And the other thing is, somebody asked a very good question, is this ABC is the dimension of the group. That it's because where do we introduce them? It come with the parameters. So there is a fixed number of these generators. Okay? There are a fixed number of them. They have some relationship between them with the structure constant. And each of a TATBTC can be a M by M matrix. So the size of this generator can be quite arbitrary for different group, for the same group. But for the same group, there are only that many generators. Okay. So now we have the structure of the group. What does it say for the representation? It actually says a lot. It says just a little bit less than SU2, but everything else. That we can say for everybody. So there is something called the adjoint wrap. It's defined this way. It says, I'm only using my structure constant. I'm going to define a M by M matrix that's equal to N. So let's say this is a number of generator, all dimension of group, and this is the dimension of the rep. So they say, if you happen to have your dimension of the rep equals your dimension of group, then a representation always exists. Okay, so in order to show this is a rep, of course, we go back to the structure constant. So the idea is you can plug this in. You can see you have a bunch of structure constants. But it happens to be that because we're talking about commutator, there is a very famous identity include three of them. Do you know what's that? Jacobi? Jacobi identity says class cyclic. That's not gonna go pick up. Okay. You can use the definition and use Jacobi identity. You can show that indeed, if you just define that every single matrix, n of them m by m to be this, you're good. So I'll leave this as an exercise. That you need to be relabeling a lot of the ABCDEs. So there's not much point for me to do it on the board. But you do some labeling. Okay, so here is a very funny thing. If M equals N, spanned by the generator, so if M equals N, that means you have a M by M operator acting the size of vector space is, what's the size of the vector space? If you're in an adjoint representation, what's the size of your vector space? There are two answers, and they are both correct. Yes?
The dimension of the group,
that's a correct answer. And it's also equals to the dimension of space. Both are right. Okay, but how many generators we have? Same number. Can we consider as a vector space spanned by the generators? Yes, you can. So it's a very crazy representation. You can use the generator as an operator as you always does, but you can also use your generator as the basis of the vector. So when you have a vector space, what do you want to do? What would be a nicer vector space? And be able to talk about the size, big or not small? Yeah? The mathematical defined vector space is different, for example, from our coordinate space, right? In our coordinate, I say I walk 2 meters over there. That doesn't happen in vector space. So to make it nicer, we can define the inner product. And here we go. We have one vector, two vector. how am I supposed to get the inner product maps two vectors to a number? Now I have two matrix. Can you think of a way to map it into a number so I can call it the inner product? Two matrix multiply together give me a matrix. How do I turn a matrix into a number?
Take the norm.
Take the norm, which is the trace. So let's do that. And let's just assume that it's in particular very nice that it's delta AB and the lambda. And if it's not nice enough, you just change your basis. Eventually, it will be nice. Okay. This kind is kind of like our space. So we're looking at a Euclidean algebra known as compact. If lambda is smaller than zero, the Lorenzi ones will be non-compact, which we'll not discuss at this point, except the Lorenz group that we know and beloved is also non-compact. But nevertheless, that's tomorrow's story. Tomorrow we'll see how we can avoid all this difficulty of studying Poincaré group. But now we can do this thing something cool. We can use a generator, which is operator, acting a generator, which is a vector. Because it can be both. M equals N, then some crazy things happens. So what do you expect this to be? I'll give you the result. The result is a vector. What do you think will show up in that vector? Then we can skip some derivation. You have two vector. You want to get a third vector. What do you do? Like in the quantum mechanics point of view, you have two observable. And what do you want to do? I give you a position, I give you a momentum. What do you want to do about them? Like,
on the commutator?
To put it in the commutator. So this is a two-line derivation, so I decided not to do it because we can sort of guess the answer. I mean, commutators are very important. And here I come back to my toolbox and I put a commutator. You'd say that this toolbox will help us eventually after we fill out the entries. Okay, so that's all I want to say about adjoint wrap. So we said something in general, what the structure constant is nice. But actually there is some other, when some things happened, then this is nicer. For example, we have already assumed that, but let's come, this, the thing is it works for non-unitary generator two. But now let's come back. If it's unitary, what do you? Yeah.
I have one question. So when we started with the representations of the groups, but now
yeah.
We're on the Lie algebra level.
That's right.
So this is a representation of Lie algebra.
That's right. Then we just use that to go back.
And could you say what is the properties of the of this inner product? Because so now this inner product,
yeah,
you could have just defined all the labels, right?
Deep.
So this inner product is defined on the vector space of Lie algebra.
That's right.
Right. So we could just define normal Euclidean inner product on the Lie algebra, right? On the labels. But
okay.
We define as the trace of the representation. So how is these two inner products are different?
So what's the other one?
Sorry.
What's the?
Mm-hmm. So what are my vectors? Vectors.
Yeah.
It's like 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, which means that like 0 times first generator, 0 times second generator, 1 times third generator, and so on, right? So I have a vector in my Lie algebra.
Okay, yes.
And so basically, if I have vectors, it means I can define scalar product
Yeah.
That, right? Euclidean scalar product, for example.
Yeah, but your zero times that thing is a matrix, right? Even in the algebra. So if you say I build up a T1 plus T2, right? This thing.
Yeah.
But this thing itself is a matrix. T1 itself is a matrix.
Yeah, sure. And but I was just saying, like, since you're defining linear product on the vector space itself.
Yeah.
So why do we need this linear product? And maybe they are the same, but I don't see exactly why they're the same.
Okay. How about I need to read something, because that's what the particle physics likes to do, that inner product. And yeah, I'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll think about it. Okay, so where am I? Okay, so the question is, so if you just look at this very beautiful structure constants, and assuming TA and TB are unitary, what do you think the structure constant would be? You need to make a step that if it's unitary, that means these things are where did we do that? There. No. Where is the first one? It's probably color. What's the first conclusion? Right there. U dagger equals 1. Here. If it's a unitary representation, we conclude that TA is
Hermitian.
So if TA is Hermitian, what do you think that it would tell us about the structure constant? What, it's a bunch of constants. So what if it's a Hermitian of a constant, that means this constant is real. So I'm not gonna show that to you. This one takes 2 lines. What do you want to do is, of course, take this equation that I have keep copying, take a dagger. Just work out this and compare to itself. You will find out that sometimes structure constants is real, which is very nice. And the next thing that I'm also not going to show, but I will claim, is that if I have this, then we can compute the structure constant using commutators. So because the trace of this thing is just itself, and TC and TC will meet, this delta will disappear. It's up to some factors of lambdas, but this works. But now you look at the right center, you have a trace of 3 different objects. What does a trace of 3 different objects tells us? Like, what do you want to do? When you have 3 things, you take a trace, you do the cyclic, which means FABC is cyclic. But we know the first pair is antisymmetric, plus the cyclic, which tells us most of the time it is actually completely antisymmetric. Not true for Lorentz. We need some serious trick to handle Lorentz and Poincaré.
Sorry, go on.
Yep.
So in order for that to be completely anti-symmetric, we need U to be unitary. Only the
we no, we needed this. We need it's like compact. It's like all the lengths of the vector of these generators to be in the Euclidean space, not in Lorentz. So if you have some generators, you can basically orthonormal. So if they can all be orthonormal, this is totally cool. But if they are also, but normal to minus one sum of them, then this is not cool. And the last thing I want to say is that if a group is simple, then the adjoint wrap is not only a universal wrap, it's even an E-wrap. I'm waiting for you guys to ask me questions. There's an elephant in the room. I said, if the group is simple, yeah, you're happy? There's some, I'm producing a question. I say, if a group is simple and blah, blah will happen.
What is a simple group?
What is simple? Well, because this is important to us, because simple is not simple. Simple says that you don't have a non-trivial invariant subgroup. No, the simple, well, semi-simple is nice. Semi-simple says it's a bunch of simple direct product together. But simple is that. Okay. To have some intuition, I would say simple group is some group that you can't understand it as product or any sort of product of smaller groups. But let's see, and you should continue chase me and say, what is an invariant subgroup? How do they move? They're just there. Okay, some other people will also call it a normal. I don't know why they are normal, but okay, so for me to understand this invariant subgroup is sort of, it's try to, I know abelian group everybody love because it's simple, but then everybody get bored because it's too boring. So let's, the idea of this invariant subgroup is kind of a commuting, but it's like a community commuting. As a community, they will commute. So this is commute. It's a very strong requirement. Basically, you take a group and require that, and it becomes something like boring and already known everything about. But what we want to introduce is an idea of somewhat commute. It says G. Okay, so this H1 is something belongs to this normal subgroup, H2, 2. G is any in J. So although G and a member of this community does not commute, but whatever you get doesn't get out of the community. And that works for all the G. And I like to draw it. Says G is commuting with this blob called N. Okay, so that's how I would think about it. Is this some community, some collective identity called N, which is commuting with G. And that thing is called an invariant subgroup. And you were like, do I care about a simple group? We do. Because somebody has classified all the possible representation for all the semi-simple, which means stronger than simple, Lie algebra. All of them. So what? But it is Poincaré simple? No. So what I'm talking about? Well, the thing is that to see SU2 is simple, and then we're gonna study all the representation of SU2. I just need to take a leap of faith between Poincaré and SU2. It turns out it's not that far stretched. Yep.
I'm a bit confused. So are you saying that if a group is simple, then all the elements commute? And if
oh, sorry. So very good. If it's simple, if it doesn't have this.
Oh.
So it doesn't have any of this. So simple means no. Means no non-trivial, means basically no invariant subgroup, but you know, identity is always the invariant subgroup, so they have to put this thing in front of you. So this is not hard to, it's just no identity. Everybody has identity as this. And the simple group means it doesn't have an invariant subgroup. So you would be asking, what could go non-simple if I have an environment subgroup? So mostly you can build some, what you can is you can build some product group out of it. So for example, okay, this is another gadgets. Oh. In case I will drop my phone, which always happens, this thing. Think about this thing. We're going to talk about an example, and it does have an invariant subgroup. And then we realize, okay, it's not simple because it can be written back as a product of other things. So that's where we're going with this thing. And this is a matrix. I don't know if you do it, but I don't. They say like something like a spring, you flip it horizontally, and a fall, you flip vertically. Then you can make your mattress like uniformly used, and then they will last longer. No, I don't do it. But this is a very good group. So let's look at our matrix group to understand a little bit better why we don't want invariant subgroup. We'll look at the case that has a subgroup and see that you know it's actually a product. So the matrix group has identity, horizontal flip, vertical flip, and you do both. And this group you can check, it's abelian. Because I want to use a simple example. So this thing is an abelian group. And I can find a subgroup which not containing just E. And you can see that E together with anybody would be a good subgroup. It's very nice to study. And you ask, is this an invariant subgroup? Of course, the whole group is abelian. So indeed, there is this example that it is matrix group, has four elements, and I find a subgroup which is invariant. Actually, So what an invariant group does for you is you can separate your group into piles. So how do you separate a group into piles? So you have E and H. And the next one, you just take a random element there and then multiply it. So this is known as coset. If you take an invariant subgroup and then you just take all this element to multiply it. And of course, if you multiply E, you get the same. Nobody is surprised. If you multiply by H, then you get HE. And if you multiply by V, you get a V and a VH. And if you multiply by HV, you get a HV and a V. Yeah? Do you agree? If I take this group and just keep doing this. So I have a blob. I multiply the blob from the left by some element. I get another blob. And now is the classification time says, oh, this two blob is the same. This two blob is the same. So in the end, I have two blobs. So basically, we're saying that if I have an invariant subgroup, I will be able to separate my original group into a bunch of blobs. Then you can see there is a product here, right? Is the number of blob times the size of the blob will give me the entire group. So I can call this the E blob, blob E, and the blob V. And I can even make a new group called the blob E and the blob V. And this is what people call it, the quotient. So let me state it again. You have an invariant subgroup. Then because you have an invariant subgroup, just multiply the whole subgroup by every single element from the original group. That will produce a bunch of sets, but some of them are equivalent. Each non-equilibrium one, okay. So this blob, okay, sorry. This blob is not an invariant subgroup. It's a coset. If you want, I can turn it into an insect. It's because it's not the invariant subgroup. So if you multiply your blob with every single group member from your group, which I did, and I realized some of them look exactly the same. They just switch the order, but I'm set. I don't care about order. Then you find out all your inequivalent cosets, and then realize the number of the coset times the size of the blob is the size of the group. Okay, and then if you make a group of the coset, this is called the quotient group. So you can also say, basically you can also say, what's a simple group? Simple group doesn't have a quotient group. you can't be dividing by something, which is the normal invariant sum. So hopefully this is okay. So that's, well, okay. The last one is that if you take our original group and then you direct product of this quotient group, you can check, it will give you EHVHV, which is our original group. So one way of saying simple group is it doesn't have a quotient group. Or the other say is it cannot be written as some sort of product. We'll emphasize a little more tomorrow about what do you mean by some sort of a product. But I think this is take the fewest number of elements that I can demonstrate to you that a case. And that's basically we claim this thing is not a simple. Because you have all these things going on. And the simple group can also be very enriched, which is the SU2. Okay, I think I'll stop here. And if you have questions, ask questions. If you have a form next to you, please fill out the form. It's always good to get a feedback. Yep.
So why can we always form quotient group only if you have a normal subgroup? Why does that mean normal? I never can.
Why is
that? Well, if I form a quotient group, I usually like model by something normal.
Yeah.
Why is it normal? Just like why do I require something?
Because if you're not normal, you do this, you might not be. So basically, you have a big group like this, and the normal subgroup give you this. They are all distinct. So if you remove the normal, maybe those two blobs will overlap. Then it doesn't make sense. So these are cosets. The first one is the normal one, and then the rest are all in the coset.
You want to form equivalence classes, right?
Yeah.
So basically, your equivalence classes are these differences with these normal elements.
But why can't I model by like the right cosets, for example, right? Because if I just model, then I differentiate between right cosets, left cosets. So why can't I just like model by the right?
But the coset means you already.